Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. We would like to wish a warm welcome to our new listeners on the brand new station KGVM in Gallatin Valley, Montana. On today's show, we are talking about capitalism. How has capitalism shaped our modern world? How has the pursuit of cheap things, things like cheap labor, care, energy, and nature, shaped our societies? In the new book, Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet, Raj Patel and Jason Moore explore these questions. They take a deep dive into the history of capitalism and its socio-ecological impacts, and they propose new ways to understand and reclaim the planet in this very turbulent 21st century. Today, we are joined by Raj Patel, an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. Raj Patel is a research professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, a really great book. And his latest, he's co-author of Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Hi, Raj. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back. Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. Congratulations on another very important book. This one takes a deep dive into what capitalism is and how we should understand it, not really just as an economic system, but as a way of organizing the relationship between humans and the rest of nature. How did you come up with this angle for this book?
It's the result of work that both myself and Jason Moore have been doing for quite some time. And what we wanted to do is just show how it is that capitalism is, as you say, a way of organizing nature. And really to answer the question that we get asked quite a lot, which is, okay, well, what is capitalism actually? When did it start? What is it? What can I do about it? One of the ways that we felt that a lot of the important stuff was being missed was in the discussion of capitalism purely as an economic system. And it isn't. It is a way of putting humans in a particular kind of relationship with the rest of the planet. We really wanted to get to the heart of that in this History of the World in Seven Cheap Things.
And you argue that what has changed is capitalism. Modern history has changed since the 1400s, and it's unfolded in what is better termed as capitalocene. Can you describe that term?
Sure. Well, so it may be the case that many of the listeners have heard of the term Anthropocene.
Right. And
Anthropocene is meant to be this era where if you look into the historical, or if you look into the geological record, you will find traces of what humans have done to the planet. And some of those traces involve things like atmospheric nuclear weapons tests, or plastic, for example, plastic in the sea. By 2050, there will be more plastic in the sea than fish. If that seems like a cause for despair, only 3 years before that, the last commercial fish catch would have landed in 2047. But the big thing that we're interested in showing is that it's not all humans who are responsible for this transformation. When you hear Anthropocene, you think, oh, humans are bad because they've done all this. But it's not really humans per se. And some humans have had absolutely no contribution to profound ecological transformation. And really what we wanted to suggest is that it's not all humans at all, but it's a system in which many humans find themselves caught up, and that system is capitalism. And so calling it the Capitalocene is both more accurate to describe what it is that's causing these planetary shifts, but it's also more optimistic in that not only was there a world before capitalism, there is right now. There are several civilizations that exist without it, and there will be a world after capitalism, too.
I mean, this is a massive undertaking, Raj. You know, every Monday on your call, we focus on climate change, sea level rise, the fact that the oceans are being overfished. And then we're talking also about how so many jobs have been exported overseas. We just did a show about the fire at the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh, and those mostly women are making about 35 cents an hour. And I mean, we are just, as you say, in a very tumultuous time right now. And you've really looked at so many issues. What would you say is your overall goal with this book and the message?
Well, the overall goal, first of all, is just to observe that capitalism never pays its bills, and so you know we run through the seven things that capitalism has so far managed to avoid paying the bills for, and we can talk about that in a second. But also by calling them cheap, we're pointing out that both that they have been cheapened, but also that for all of these things, the bills are starting to become due, whether it's around labor or about care work or around nature. There's no way to avoid paying these bills or postponing paying these bills indefinitely, and many of these bills are coming due. And so what we wanted to do in this book is really show, first of all, that capitalism emerges itself from a period of climate change and from epidemic disease, that we are heading to a similar period now, and that there are, as I say, civilizations that that offer alternatives to, as you say, the big planetary state shifts that we're undergoing, and that while it's important to learn from them, we ought not to be either sanguine or over-optimistic about our chances. But on the other hand, if we do nothing, we're guaranteed some fairly certain peril.
You show how the modern world has been made through seven cheap things: nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives. How did you come up with that list?
Well, it was an inductive list. I mean, we've essentially been sort of looking at the history of capitalism and looking at the different ways that bills don't get paid. And so one of the examples that we use to try and sort of communicate this is the chicken nugget. Just very quickly, I mean, the idea is that the chicken nugget is the sort of example of what is our signature sort of accomplishment as humanity, because if you look into the fossil record, you'll find trillions of chicken bones, because humans go through 50 billion chickens a year now, and so the world's most popular bird is the chicken. It'll soon become the world's most popular meat, and that meat is taken out of nature, and we alter it as we see fit, discarding 50% of the genetic diversity in the process. And on top of that, you need workers who are treated incredibly badly. Those workers' bodies are broken, and then, of course, it's back to the community with those workers, and it's usually unpaid care work that's responsible for rehabilitating and sustaining those workers. Those workers, of course, need cheap food, and the nugget is part of that sort of complex of cheap food. Those workers also need cheap fuel in order to survive, as does the manufacturer of these chicken nuggets. And all along the way, we find patterns of abuse in the labor force, such that if you look at the modern poultry industry today, people in it are predominantly people of color and often women on the poultry production line. And so what we try to do is run the gamut and suggest that all of this is underwritten by, you know, cheap loans to the food industry, and all the way you have cheap nature, cheap labor, cheap care, cheap food, cheap fuel, cheap lives, cheap money. And the reason we present capitalism in this way is really just to say, look, there are lots of movements around the world that already get it. What we're trying to do in this book is sort of unify or provide some way for movements that are in the struggle to recognize one another, as many of them already are. So if you look at the movement for Black Lives, the movement for Black Lives is interested not only, of course, in systemic racism, but also in local economic control, in reparations, in understanding and combating and getting reparations for climate change. And if you look at movements like La Via Campesina, the international peasant movement, they're interested obviously in food, but also in domestic violence, in a transformation of the way that gender relations happen, and that work gets paid for, and that people have a relationship with nature. And so what we're doing in this book is really observing that many of the movements that are trying to transform the world find themselves doing so intersectionally. And that's one of the ways that, you know, while when we break down the operations of capitalism to seven things, what we're doing is really just providing seven dimensions in along which different movements are already seeing one another.
Raj Patel is co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. Let's spend some more time talking about chicken, because you write, the most telling symbol of the modern era is not the automobile or the smartphone. It is the chicken nugget, the most popular meat in the United States. It's projected to be the planet's favorite flesh by the year 2020, And as you point out, Raj, and I mean, these numbers are just really very hard to comprehend, that 50 billion birds are killed every year for human consumption. I'm sure you knew a lot about this before you tackled this project, but what really stood out for you when you did your research specifically on chickens?
Well, I mean, obviously the sort of scale of slaughter is just unfathomable. I mean, you know, there are 12 billion chickens alive right now, but not for long. From sort of hatching out of the shell to becoming a nugget is 90 days. That boggled the imagination to start off with. But really one of the things that blew my mind, that I still find difficult to get my head around, is some of the labor practices that accompany the industrial chicken industry, particularly in the United States, where I think Oxfam USA did a calculation where if you buy a chicken nugget, about 2 cents of your dollar spent on nuggets goes to labor. But in some cases, the chicken industry has managed to avoid paying full price for labor in a couple of devious ways. One is to use incarcerated labor, so to use prison labor that gets remunerated, I think, about 25 cents an hour. And in one particularly audacious case, some chicken executives set up an opioid rehabilitation center where, through a mixture of faith and prayer, people who were in treatment for opioid addiction and who were sent there, usually through the criminal justice system as an alternative to incarceration, would both, you know, spend a part of the day in prayer and then quite a lot of the day working on the chicken line as part of their treatment and getting paid nothing for it. And so there's something both startlingly and horrifically modern about this process. There's something very new about it, because the opioid addiction, of course, is a very not modern phenomenon, but it's also very medieval. That the souls of people who find themselves in the care of this particular system can be redeemed through prayer and through hard work. Well, that was exactly the kind of logic that allowed conquistadors to enslave indigenous and native and aboriginal Americans in the original kind of sins of colonialism. And so it was startling for us to both find this very modern system of people being paid nothing and being exposed to horrors in the industrial poultry system, but also to connect it back to really one of the original labor tactics of the colonial exploitation of the New World.
Yeah, I really appreciated how you did that, looking at what we're dealing with today and really where it comes from. And I had to read this part twice. You write, if you worked and prayed hard enough for the duration of your treatment, you'd be allowed to re-enter society. You also report that it is very hard to find staff when, according to one study in Alabama, 86% of employees who cut the chicken wings are in pain because of the repetitive hacking and twisting on the line.
Well, and of course, you know, it's also a little terrifying that there are limits to the number of birds per minute,
right,
that can be killed in the industrial processing of chicken here in the United States. And I think that's around about 140 birds per minute. And the poultry industry is lobbying the USDA fairly hard to raise that number or to remove the cap so that they can operate at speeds closer to the birds per minute slaughter rate in Germany or in Brazil, which is nearer 200 birds per minute. It's not surprising then that workers are exposed to those levels of occupational injury. And when a study was conducted, you could find the findings for workers exposed to occupational injury in the poultry industry were far higher than the American average.
And the Trump administration is wanting to do the same thing with pork processing. Mother Jones has a great piece about this. Currently, 16 pigs are killed per minute at an average pork slaughterhouse, and various companies like Smithfield are lobbying the USDA to increase those speeds.
And again, I mean, that's part of this process of cheapening, right? I mean, the idea is that in this moment of trying to wring out the last dollar of profit from the line, so many forces are at work. I mean, the government itself is in the business of doing agricultural and veterinary research for the industry to be able to create the most profitable pigs. So our tax dollars are going towards the transformation of pigs into these meat machines. And then, of course, the regulations are off, workers are exploited. In some cases, the slaughterhouses are lobbying for reduced rates so that they don't have to pay full whack for insurance, and said that becomes an article of public subsidy. And all of this, of course, is part of the dynamics that we're pointing to, that cheap care, cheap work, cheap nature is all tremendously important, but so are the inputs into this process. Cheap chicken feed, for example, according to one study, I think $1.25 billion worth of chicken feed, $1.25 billion is the public subsidy towards chicken feed. So it's not just that workers need cheap food, but the feed that chickens get itself is an object of public subsidy. And again, all along the way, this is about capitalists trying not to pay the bills that are due. But here's the deep irony, that if you look at the bird flu epidemics that so far have only managed to kill a sort of fraction of their potential, the smart money suggests that the industrial slaughterhouses that we have today are perfect breeding grounds for epidemic disease. And so we are very literally sort of authors of the kinds of dynamic that led to the initial formation of capitalism, of epidemic disease coming at a time of climate change.
You also write that 14.5% of all anthropogenic carbon dioxide CO2 emissions are from livestock production. And given that the climate crisis is really topping our conversation about the future of the planet, it's just becoming more and more clear that this is all so connected.
Well, it is, but of course, when we talk about livestock production, it's important really to point the finger at industrial livestock production. Humans have had relations, have had a very interesting and very deep kind of connection to the animal world and the rest of nature. And it's only through the sort of modern objectification of animals and, as I say, the sort of the industrialization of slaughter that we see a real profound spike in emissions really coming from the industrial slaughterhouse process. And much less the small-scale farmers. Though, of course, it's interesting that small-scale farmers get blamed for emissions rises and for unsustainable production, whereas, in fact, it is the industrial slaughterhouse system that's far more responsible for these disastrous emissions.
Raj, how do you see this playing out as there's a lot more awareness about these issues right now? A lot of reports are coming out about how workers are exploited, about how animals are exploited, how this is an environmental justice issue, because a lot of these slaughterhouses tend to be near low-income areas and areas that are predominantly people of color. But the demand for meat and animals is really increasing around the globe. How do you see this playing out in the coming years?
I think you've put your finger on the difficult moment here, Rose, where if we allow the marketing of meat to continue the way that it is, I don't see it playing out very well. We'll see an intensification of the exploitation of workers that we already see. But on the other hand, we are seeing a moment globally of workers saying enough is enough. Whether it's in China, where there's a resurgence of workers striking, or even here in the United States, where even in states where striking is difficult, workers have and unions in particular have pushed back against the vast exploitation under which they labor. I see things both moving towards this sort of precipice, and I don't think it's worth sugarcoating anything to say that we are already in experiencing climate change, particularly in low-income communities, and particularly in the global south, and at the same time pointing out that there are systems, there are organizations, there are movements that are pushing back very forcefully and very creatively. I think it's both important to say that one oughtn't to to be deluded. One ought to have a pessimism of the intellect, but an optimism of the will.
Today we're speaking with Raj Patel, co-author of the book A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. He writes about nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives. These are the seven things that have made our world and will shape its future. In making these things cheap, modern commerce has transformed, governed, and devastated the Earth. And Raj and his co-author Jason Moore offer a new way of really understanding the planet in this turbulent 21st century. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Every Monday, we talk about what is going on in our world in terms of climate change, overfishing, sea level rise, animal agriculture, lots of things here. And we need to talk about and embrace alternatives. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
That's very kind of you, Rose. Thank you very much. I wanted to point out that that is exactly our argument, and it's been, that is to say, radical feminism. That has been our argument since the early 70s, and what the way we posited it was, woman is nature. And so as these boys go around and bend everything to their will while they're living in mom's basement, or like I say, spitting in our face while they're standing on our shoulders, I'm just thrilled that the gentlemen have written this book. Also, I wanted to ask him if he's seen the book by Waring called If Women Counted. She's an Australian economist and was a legislator, and I think you might enjoy her book if you haven't already gotten into it.
Thank you, Katie. Well, I'm a big fan of Marilyn Waring's book, If Women Counted, is phenomenal. We also use Silvia Federici's book, Caliban and the Witch, and if we're standing on anyone's shoulders, it's on hers, particularly in the analysis of both feminism and colonialism. Thank you very much for that comment. I do think it's very interesting that in order for the understandings of nature that we have today to obtain, we do have to forget the understandings of nature that pre-existed either on this side of the Atlantic or indeed in Europe. When we're using work like Silvia Federici's, what we're doing and what we're hoping to point out is that the twin processes of colonialism and of the sort of debasement of women's work and women's knowledge go hand in hand. And that means that, for example, that women and men who were more connected or had knowledge about the natural world that didn't comport with or require different arrangements from those of colonists, well, those people had to be exterminated. And that's part of the animus behind the genocide of indigenous peoples here, but also behind the burning of witches in Europe. White women were also persecuted if they dared to stand up against this new kind of tyranny of organizing society and nature. Those witch burnings continue to today. And Silvia Federici's work looking at witch burnings, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa is tremendously interesting because what she's doing is pointing out that where people get attacked as witches is precisely where it is that is at capitalism's frontier, where women are demanding access to a common land or protesting against the incursion of extractive industries, for instance. And so you're absolutely right that that actually, in order for certain for these relationships of humans to nature and in particular women to nature to be as twisted as they are today, a great deal has to be exterminated and amnesia needs to be enforced.
Well, thank you for that, KDF, and we'll continue talking about your question right after the break. We're speaking today with Raj Patel, author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Raj Patel. He and Jason Moore have written a book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question or comment, these are big issues, and clearly there needs to be a lot of changes when you look at what's happening with the climate, agriculture, poverty, cheap labor. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Just to stick with KDF's question for a couple more minutes, Raj, you did amazing research here and looked at women resisting from, you know, Europe to the United States. What really stood out for you when you were doing your research specifically on that issue?
Well, one of the movements that I'm just blown away by is the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina. In the Latin American section of La Via Campesina, there's a really interesting sort of brand of feminism called Feminismo Campesino Popular, which is, you know, popular peasant feminism. And what that points to, and what it's arguing for, is both gender equality, obviously, and an end to domestic violence. And domestic violence is one of the contributors to food insecurity around the world, and it's not discussed nearly enough. But the women in La Via Campesina are demanding not just an end to domestic violence, but also a recognition of precisely what KDS's question was asking, was reminding us, that actually the humans need more of a connection to the natural world than metropolitan feminism seems to acknowledge. What was really exciting was to see this really incredibly well-theorized, practical peasant feminism emerging just at the moment when we need it most, to see a kind of understanding of equality, but also of understanding of humans' place in the ecological world and the importance of a knowledge that situates humans back into the web of life in a way that some kinds of feminism just don't do.
Mm. So, such a good point. Thank you so much for calling in, KDF. Let's go next to Tiffany. Hi, Tiffany. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay, great. I'm a teacher of community college English, and my students, I actually assign them to read the introduction to this book.
Oh.
Yeah. So they're very excited to read about it, and I find it useful in so many ways to connect Patel and Moore are redefining capitalism in terms of something that organizes nature as well as labor's back to the history of colonialism and enslavement. So all that is very useful. My students have a question about how a capitalist is being defined. They wanted to know whether, for example, the people who work in the chicken slaughterhouses, are those capitalists, or are we all capitalists just by virtue of existing in this system? And I think where they're getting at is they want to know where is the space for their own agency as citizens, who are not going to mostly be academics that want to understand how to, you know, make good choices in this society.
Well, thank you. And Tiffany, if you can stand the line for just a minute, I have a question about your students. Raj, do you want to take that?
Well, I first of all, thank you, Tiffany, for sharing the chapter, and thank you, your students, for asking exactly the right question. I mean, I think for the most part, most of us are caught up in the circuits of capitalism, and what we have to sell is our labor, and so that's what we do. I think what's interesting is that although we draw on this long history of colonialism, and we talk about Columbus, you know, sort of sailing the ocean blue and being one of the sort of originary capitalists, what we're also pointing out is that long history of capitalism always involves this sort of layer cake of exploitation. You know, right at the top, let me give you an example that sits well in the Bay Area. of a capitalist who is who does all the things that Columbus used to do, who is able to chat up bankers so that he can get vast amounts of cash, despite having not such a great track record, and who is able to exploit his workers with calls from his factories to the National Labor Relations Board, just in the same way as Columbus exploited his workers, the sailors on his ship, and who relies on slavery whether he chooses it or not. In the same way, I mean, Columbus very obviously wanted slaves, but in the modern day, there is slavery in things like our cell phones. There's modern-day slavery and forced labor in the gaining of the rare earth metals like tantalum that's in our expensive cell phones. And the capitalist I'm thinking of today is Elon Musk. Elon Musk is sort of the modern-day Columbus, right? I mean, he's the capitalist who sees the sees the future of humanity in colonization. He wants to colonize Mars. Columbus wanted to colonize the New World. But in every case, the sort of dynamics are the same, that there are, beyond, other than the capitalists and the bankers who support that activity, there is this sort of layered exploitation of the people lucky enough to be officers on the ships, and then the grunt workers on the ships, and then the slaves. Capitalism has always experimented with this, these sort of periods, these kinds of labor relations, where you layer just brute exploitation and obviously sort of free domestic work on top of paid menial work, on top of slightly better paid, sophisticated sort of knowledge work. But it's always the capitalists at the end, and there are really very few of them. But we sort of cooperate along with their system because our alternatives are either crushed or we're not encouraged to think about them. And so when it comes to your students, I mean, I think there are lots of ways in which your students might imagine their world differently. But shopping and becoming a green consumer is not really part of that. I think much more it's in the rebirth of the labor movement, in movements like the Movement for Black Lives or La Via Campesina, or a range of social movements that are happening around the world in terms of the recognition of certain kinds of identity, also about a connection with nature and a transformation of our energy system and our relationships within the home and at work.
Tiffany, are you still with us?
I am, thank you.
I just wonder, there have been a lot of stories about how young people see capitalism, socialism. What do you hear from your students?
There is a big range of responses in the class. I think in general, students found refreshing at first the critique of capitalism, and Patel and Moore take it back to the pre-capitalism, the feudal period. And so what I was trying to get them to think about is that, well, they say you it's hard for people to imagine a world without capitalism, and so the feudal context helps them to do so. So I thought students find it very refreshing to connect those elements, and yet a lot of the metaphors used in the intro about capitalism as a disease that keeps replicating itself, I see the virtue of that metaphor, but for 18-year-olds, I think they find it overwhelming because they want to know what's their place in that and how can they be ethical people within that system. So I think the personal agency part for 18-year-olds is a little bit difficult to find.
So interesting. Well, I hope they enjoy the show if you play it in class. Thank you for calling. Raj, what would you say to those students who say that they have a hard time imagining a world without capitalism?
Well, I'd say that, it's as we say in the introduction, for most of us, it's harder to imagine the end of capitalism than it is to imagine the end of the world. I mean, we're treated to visions of the apocalypse on television or in the movies all the time, but we're never really treated to visions of what it might be like to live in a world where we're not at the sort of beck and call of an elite, where we're selling our labor and where we are continually exploiting nature. But one of the first steps out of that fear, that horror, is to recognize that when you think that you're just one person, that's the man talking. In a sense, when you feel like you're just one person and there's only a limited amount of agency, part of what we need to remember through the good teaching choices of teachers like Tiffany, is that there are there have always been movements in which humans have got together and have built social movements to be able to build that better world. And so, and then the counter response from the smart aleck at the back is, yeah, what? If you love Cuba so much, why don't you move there? Or, if capitalism so bad, just look at Russia or China. And I think the reasoned response to that is, first of all, yes, the sort of state capitalism of these countries isn't terrific, but it's also to say, hey, you know what? There are civilizations right now that are practicing forms of economic relations that are not capitalist. There are indigenous communities that are thriving away from the state. Usually in forests around the world, you can find indigenous communities that are doing a much better job of managing their resources than capitalists do. Now, this isn't to say we should all run for the hills, but it is to say, actually, we do need to remember. We need to remember that there are there's a world beyond ours. There are human relations that are possible, not just for us to execute through a waggle of our thumbs over our phones, but actually through being together, through building, through actually engaging with one another, through exchanging in ways that are not capitalist. And those futures are there to be taken if you allow yourself to dream them.
Well, thank you for calling, Tiffany. Today we're joined by Raj Patel, co-author of the book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. The book focuses on seven areas that are the foundation of modern commerce, including nature, work, energy, and lives. How has the cheapening of these things made the world safe for capitalism? That's one of the many questions Raj and his co-author Jason Moore ask. And what needs to change to reclaim the planet? Let's go next to Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I'll try to... I have many topics to bring up. Mainly, I was calling about cell harvesting for the pet food industry, but also African-American woman Majora Carter. She wrote the first chapter of The Vertical Farm by Dr. Despommier, and The Vertical Farm could solve all these problems, and same with cell harvesting could solve all of these problems. And Monsanto's Roundup is causing toxic shock in tampons and even the pads, the feminine pads, the cotton with Monsanto's around. Well, Bill Gates owns one third of Monsanto's. It caused one woman athlete to lose her legs, toxic shock syndrome. So I think half the nation of Republican women should be really angry about this and fear for their daughters getting toxic shock syndrome and losing their legs. So don't use Roundup or weed killer. Look for local garden plants that thrive in your area without pesticide. Also,
Kathy, thank you for calling. We actually did a show about Roundup a couple of months back. You can find it if you just search at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Ruby, and she writes, I've often thought that we may be preaching to the converted, or are we? Has Raj's book been reviewed in USA Today, for example?
Thank you for both those comments. I don't think it's yet been reviewed in USA Today, though, of course, we'd be grateful for it. But I do take the point that sometimes this does feel like preaching to the converted. But that's why, first of all, we wrote the book with some heavy ideas, but with a prose that we thought would be accessible and that could be taught in high schools. And again, thank you, Tiffany, and your students for reading it. But also, I think that there are different ways in which ideas can and should be presented. And so I'm also working with the director Steve James, who did the great American documentary Hoop Dreams, to present some of these ideas in ways that can be shared as part of a documentary, shared at a movie screening or shared in a church hall or a union hall. I absolutely agree that there are ways in which we can be seen as preaching to the converted, and that's why I'm heading to churches, because I'm very interested in engaging with these ideas with communities, particularly in parts of the country that may not get to hear this show, that I think can be very productive. I mean, just to give you a quick example, what we've been doing for the past 7 years is traveling the country, working in Malawi with women who are ending hunger through gender equality and transforming relationships with nature, within a group called the Soil, Food, and Healthy Communities Project. And last year they said, well, you know, this is all well and good, and we're doing great work here in Malawi, but climate change is a big issue for us, and we want to understand why Americans don't accept climate change. We want to talk to Americans so that we can persuade them. And so last year we just stuck it all on our credit cards and brought our Malawian friends everywhere from the White House to Trump country in the Midwest, and we had these conversations in ways that are a different kind of language to the ones that we're using on our show right now. But which nonetheless, you have to find the right language to meet people where they're at. And so what works in this book may not work in rural Wisconsin, but the search for the language is important, because at some level, almost everyone we spoke to was feeling the pinch of one of these seven cheap things, whether it was the expense of care or a disconnection from nature or illness caused by the industrial food system, whatever it is. Everyone's kind of feeling this right now, which is why the global sort of end of the cheapness of these seven things is a real and present phenomenon. And so I do think that, yes, there is a danger of preaching to the converted, but I also think that people who are not reading this book, but who are around the world, are absolutely feeling the limits of the end of capitalism.
Well, thank you for the question, Ruby. Today we're joined by Raj Patel, co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Today it is our One Planet series, and we're talking about how the cheapening of things like work, nature, energy has made the world safe for capitalism, and what needs to change to reclaim the planet. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And Raj, what you just said about going to different communities, even different parts of the world, and so many people are really hurting. I mean, here in the United States, the poverty level is high. 48 million people are on food stamps. And what are your thoughts about, the rise of populism that we are seeing here and around the world as the result of neoliberal economic policies? And absent of some kind of alternative, again, what are your thoughts about where we're going in the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that there's, that poverty and inequality are serious problems, not just in the Bay Area, but in the United States and beyond. And I do think that the sort of tentacles of populism grow out of the sort of fertile soil of neoliberalism and of a project that has been championed both by Democrats and Republicans through the 1980s and 1990s. People are looking wherever we went in sub-Saharan Africa with this film project, or where we traveled through the United States. It's a cliche to say there was a lot more that unites people than divides us, but it certainly seems to be true that people are, across the world are wanting just a basic standard, a standard of recognition of their lives. And capitalism deals in cheap lives, that when people are discarded, when people are affronted, when dignity and respect is only available for the rich, that's not a world in which most people feel comfortable or want to find themselves. And if someone comes along peddling an alternative that actually speaks a language of dignity and respect, no matter how dog-whistled the racism is in that that message, then it's more likely to get heard than in a system that negates dignity. So, this is not to in any way condone the rise of my colleague and I in the past have called global fascism. But it is to say that it's not surprising that this might be one of the end games of modern liberalism. And if you want to see what that might look like, in a country where the head of state uses a social media platform to find radical Islamic terrorism around every corner and is ready to whip up the masses to engage in certain kinds of killing. You just look to India, where Narendra Modi uses his vast social media platform to do precisely that, and where people are correct in observing that in many ways Narendra Modi is a fascist. So, I don't think that we have to, there's room for any kind of complacency right now when one thinks about how it is that these various crises of capitalism end. But again, I think it's important to recognize the dynamics that are in play and also recognize the movements that exist to fight them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you in our remaining 2 minutes, Raj. Talk a little bit about the movements. I mean, the most effective ways for these movements to really start to change the tide.
Well, I mean, I think, when you have a union movement that is resurgent, when you have the movement for Black Lives, for example, that is doing such amazing work in sort of building alliances, when you have Native Lives Matter, when you have the amazing work that's happening in and around Standing Rock, there are movements across the United States in which young people from from the classrooms all the way up to the Gray Panthers out there in the East Bay offer a vision and a leadership that is not just about individual consumption decisions, but it is about getting together with your neighbors and with your community and recognizing the solidarity and the debt that is owed for the way that we live in the global north to the global south. And the discharging of that debt of reparations, if you like, is both a sort of psychologically difficult process, but it can be incredibly liberating. And that's one of the things that we end our book on, is this sort of call to understand the power of the working class, certainly, but also of what it is that working class might reconstitute itself as if there were to be a more meaningful relationship between humans and the web of life.
And in the end, Raj's sections are reparation, redistribution, reimagination, very important, and recreation. Raj Patel is an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. His new book, which he co-authored with Jason Moore, is A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. As always, Raj, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for joining us.
For everyone at KALW, and particularly the new donors who've joined in this hour.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.